All right, we are going to read Genesis 49. We're going to read the entire, actually, we're going to read verse through verse 27. We'll pick up with verse 28 next week. So we're going to read through verse 27 of Genesis 49. Hear the word of the Lord. Then Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together that I may tell you what shall happen to you in the days to come. Assemble and listen, O sons of Jacob. Listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the firstfruits of my strength. Preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul not come into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion and as a lioness. Who dares rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, and nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he has washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. Zebulun shall dwell at the shore of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall be at Sidon. Issachar is a strong donkey crouching between the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant. So he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant at forced labor. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backwards. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Raiders shall raid Gad, but he shall raid at their heels. Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal delicacies. Naphtali is a doe let loose that bears beautiful fawns. Joseph is a fruitful bow by a spring. His branches run over the wall. The archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him severely. Yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is a shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who is set apart from his brothers. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning devouring the prey, and at evening dividing the spoil. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with the blessing suitable to him. Thus ends the reading of God's holy word. Let's see, make a quick note. Now, last week we saw the adoption and blessing of Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and we noted that it was a big deal to be engrafted into those who would inherit the covenant, because this covenant consists of promises, promises about people, about land, and blessing. And this chapter is all about blessing. That's the key word of this chapter, the theme of this chapter. And so Jacob has called in his sons for the final meeting. This is the moment where he will bless them with, he's letting them know this is his last will and testament. They're finding out what they're getting when their father dies. And as we obviously saw in this text, Jacob is also acting as a prophet as he declares the future of these tribes of Israel. And so Jacob addresses the sons in three groups, and this is basically how the it's organized. The first six sons, Reuben to Issachar, are the sons of Leah. And so he addresses them, the first six. The next four are the sons of Jacob's concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah. Now it goes son of Bilhah, and then Zilpah, Bilhah. And I don't know, I couldn't find any significance in the ordering there, but that's the order. And that's Dan through Naphtali. And then finally we have Rachel's sons, Joseph and Benjamin. So it's organized according to the wives. And so and this, it helps you kind of make sense of why they went about it the way they did. Now, remember, I said last week that Genesis 48 and this chapter are connected together because we have the blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh, this, and the explanation of why they're included in and why they're considered tribes of Israel when Israel takes the land later on. And just as we noted last week how we struggle to understand God's promises, we also have an equally difficult time comprehending blessing. What does it mean to be blessed? Usually we say it in the context of a particular time where we have a lot of possessions or where our relationships with our family or at work are going particularly well. It's a moment that we call of plenty. And it's not necessarily wrong, but the question is that all blessing is? Because it seems a little incomplete, doesn't it? Because if we just ran with that definition, that's what God's blessing is, just this kind of momentary prosperity, then we could say theoretically that God blesses the wicked. Because there are plenty of people who completely reject God, who have plenty of possessions and have relatively little strife in their relationships. They're the people that we're really sheepish about sharing Jesus with because they just don't seem like they need Jesus. They seem like pretty happy atheists. So what do I'm only going to go share with the unhappy ones. And this is just a misunderstanding of what blessing is. And the thing is, if we have a superficial definition of blessing, then what we will end up doing is we'll end up actually taking sin lightly, because if we're in a time of, you know, material blessing or success in our work, yet we also know that we have been in ongoing sin, we'll think, well, maybe God doesn't think it's that big a deal. Or else why would he have given me my promotion? Or why would I have whatever it is? And even more, I don't know if it's pretty serious though, we would take the covenant promises lightly as well. If we think blessing is simply momentary prosperity. And so, this chapter though teaches us a lot about blessing. We're just going to deal with two basic points about blessing. The first one is that God's blessing does not ignore the reality of sin. God's blessing does not ignore the reality of sin, because we see that even in the blessing of these 12 sons, sin has consequences. So you look at verses 3 and 4, and you see Reuben. He's the oldest, and so he's put first. He is not given the rights of the firstborn. 1 Chronicles 5:1 tells us explicitly that Joseph gets the rights of the firstborn. And so this means that Reuben's placement is not as the firstborn, even though he was actually the first one born. It's meant to highlight what Reuben could have been, what he should have been. It's to highlight his fall from prominence and his fall from power, and to serve as a warning for future generations. Because the key adjective for Reuben would be unstable. Unstable as water, the text says. Privilege, power, natural ability, and being born into advantage do not guarantee success. And as we have seen, as we've been in for months now in this narrative about Joseph and his brothers, we've seen that Reuben has lacked the courage and determination to do what was right at the right time. He's also rash at making vows he shouldn't have, such as offering up the lives of his two sons in a vow to safeguard Benjamin. But what knocked him out of place was his sinful attempt to take control of the family by committing a form of incest and sleeping with his mother-in-law, Bilhah. And so the result of Reuben's sin is a loss of prominence in the family, and the history of Israel bears it out for the tribe. They kind of just get real weak and small, and they don't flourish. And so if you're one of those people who was born with natural gifts, whether they're physical gifts or mental gifts, if most of what you touch seems to turn to gold or to succeed, then you need to take heed of Reuben. And you must be careful to stay the course and not give way to pride and to prayerfully serve God in humility. Verses 5 to 7, we see Simeon and Levi. And these two are put together since these are the ones that attack Shechem in Genesis 34 in the defense of their sister's honor, which they had a legitimate gripe, but slaughtering the whole town for the sin of one man was not okay. Bruce Waltke, one Old Testament scholar, he goes so far as to describe the attack of Shechem. He calls it the rape of Shechem. And what we see here is the sin of vengeance, taking justice out of the hands of God and putting it into our own hands. And one of the reasons why we must entrust justice to God ultimately is that you and I have the capacity for cruelty, but God does not. All His ways are just, but we are prone to corruption. And so what's pictured here in Simeon and Levi is unbridled anger and cruelty. It's the kind of person looking for a reason to unleash their rage. And for them, any pretext will do. And perhaps they thought they had gotten away with it, because Jacob didn't say anything to them, really. He rebuked them verbally, and they threw it back in his face. And that was really, apparently, the end of it. It's been years. Yet their sin has consequences, and their tribes will be scattered amongst Israel in the years to come. Then there's Issachar, verses 14 to 15. We're going to skip over Judah. We'll come back to him. And so verses 14 to 15, and he stands out not so much for anything in particular that he did. We don't know really anything about Issachar. What we're focusing here on is the words that Jacob uses to describe what's going to happen to the people, the people of the tribe of Issachar. And so they're pictured as a strong donkey who, for a good patch of grass, becomes a servant to another master. And this is what we see in the history of Israel. Several commentators noted this, and that the tribe of Issachar will be subject to the Canaanites. They will subject themselves to the Canaanites to avoid conflict so that they can enjoy the comforts of the time. And as I was kind of thinking about Issachar, and I was meditating on that, it really struck me about how descriptive that can be of myself or us in this day and age. How many of us are willing to enslave ourselves to one degree or another in order to secure for ourselves a little comfort? What are we willing to sacrifice our distinctiveness as Christians in order to get a little relational peace with some people? Now, another thing as we're talking about this, you know, sin has consequences, but also the blessing of God in this life does not always mean prosperity, just complete and total prosperity all the time. You listen to those prosperity preachers and you think, man, everybody in this room must be just doing great. But we see several mixed blessings in the sons. And they're pictured in very vivid ways. You have Gad, the raided, and the raider. You have Dan, the venomous snake. Now, what's interesting is Dan, and a snake is not usually a positive image in Scripture for obvious reasons. You've read Genesis 3. And that's not the only place. Towards the end of the book of Judges, we see the tribe of Dan roving around Israel looking for land and engaging in idolatry. But also note that Samson, you know, the famous and, you know, the famously strong and famously flawed judge of Israel comes from the Danites as well. And we see Benjamin, the ravenous wolf. He's a mighty warrior, and the history of Israel testifies to the military prowess of the Benjaminites. Yet the picture of them as a ravenous wolf is still not a positive one, and hints at what we see in the Benjaminites and their sexual depravity and their contribution to the spiritual and political chaos that we see at the end of the book of Judges. So we just, it's not just, you know, you just get all the blessing, it just goes, it's all great, it's wonderful. So what are we supposed to learn from all this? Well, Ian Duguid says this. He says, these blessings show us the complexity of sin. That sin can be socially reprehensible, as in the case of Reuben. There's sin, you know, sins that we all go, yeah, that's nasty. Or yeah, no, that's not okay, that's wrong. Then there's also the sin that can be socially lauded in pursuing a good living by providing rich delicacies for foreigners at the cost of your spiritual distinctiveness, like Issachar. It can be something that we say, hey, you know, you can get the applause of many if you'll just capitulate to the social to the social ideas of the day, to the spirit of the age. And we who are so materially blessed should be very thoughtful about what we allow to influence us. Because affluence, the possession of wealth, lowers our defenses. And we're more willing to listen to our flesh and to yield to temptation during periods of calm and periods of plenty than we are when we are in active conflict. When we're on edge and we know we're under assault, we're fighting, we're, you know, but usually it's, you have a big victory. Why is it that it seems that sin follows the heels of a great victory? So you do something great in your life, you overcome a huge obstacle, and all of a sudden you fall into some sin. It hits you right when you're not expecting it, because it happens. It's the way sin works. Just because we are blessed doesn't mean that we won't sin. It doesn't mean that we won't make mistakes. It doesn't mean that we won't endure suffering in this life. Because sin has consequences. And those consequences can be intergenerational. We can pass on consequences of our sin to our children. And if you want to test that, just go talk to the child of an alcoholic. If the saying, no man is an island, were ever true, it is true here. Each of us is a network of relationships. And we need to know that our decisions impact those around us. And the Bible itself generally, and the blessing of God is not ignorant to the reality of sin. Rather, and this is the second point, the blessing of God makes provision for our sin. And we see this, first of all, in the inclusion simply of the 12 sons in the people of God. And when we talked about just some examples of those sons that we would say, well, you know what, if I was going to pick the 12 guys that were going to be foundational for Israel, there's some of these guys that would not make the list. Certainly. But we see that God includes them. And so their very inclusion as the foundation of the people of Israel is a testimony to God's grace. Despite the weakness and sin of these brothers, God is going to use them to create for himself a people that he's going to forge out of the fire of the furnace of Egypt and bring them into the promised land. And God is at work even in some of the what would be called anti-blessings. Those, you know, you read the stuff that's said about Simeon and Levi, it's like, that doesn't sound like much of a blessing to me. And so some scholars call them anti-blessings. But even there you see God at work. Because Numbers 25 records how Phinehas, who is a descendant of Levi, kills a man who is actively engaged in sexual immorality, and because of that sin, there was a plague on the people. And so Phinehas, out of zeal for the Lord, goes and kills this man who's engaged in this sin. And guess who the man was? He's a Simeonite. Levi and Simeon. The Levite kills the Simeonite. And the plague is lifted, and because of his action, the Levites inherit the priesthood. And you read about it in Numbers 25. And so when the people come into the land, the Levites are spread out through the cities to teach the people the law of God. And so here's the point. This is where I'm getting at. God still scatters Simeon and Levi. But Simeon, he scatters into obscurity. Levi, he scatters. And he spreads them out through the cities and they flourish. He spreads them out and he uses them to teach his word to the people. And they're the only tribe that has no inheritance because the Lord himself is their inheritance. So we see God even at work here, something that we go, that's not a blessing. We see God at work turning that around. Now we're going to narrow this in is we're going to look at two major brothers that got most of the attention in this chapter, which is going to be Joseph and Judah. We're going to take Joseph first. And Sinclair Ferguson, when he was preaching on this, he said it rightly that these two brothers, in Joseph we have the picture of fulfilled blessings, and in Judah we have the picture of future blessings. And so Joseph, verses 22 to 26, he's described as basically a rare tree that has flourished under harsh conditions in the desert. And I mean, and a tree that has really flourished, that has grown. And one of my roommates, right after I got out of college, he was dated a girl, and they're married now, but the first time he went, they lived out in the country in the middle part of Georgia, and they were driving out, and he said, "How do I get to your house?" She said, "Well, you just go down this road and you make a right at the big tree." And so he's like, "Okay, whatever." So he's driving along, and then he goes driving. "That's a big tree." and he made a right. I was in his wedding. It's a big tree, I'll tell you. And so, you know, it's that kind of massive tree that we're talking about that is pictured here, this very healthy, vibrant tree that Joseph has described. It's even speculated that the guy who wrote Psalm 1 had Joseph in mind. And so it includes a line that describing Joseph's suffering at the hand of his brothers. And we're talking about the false accusations, the enslavement, the imprisonment. This also talks about his successful endurance. It says that he was unmoved because through the suffering, his arms were made strong by the Lord. And the result is blessing on his descendants. And we talked about those last week because we talked about Ephraim and Manasseh. So we're not going to go into that tonight. But I want you to notice how the scriptures portray suffering in relationship with the sovereign God. That suffering is God's way of making our arms strong, training us and strengthening us to endure the true battle that we are fighting. And so Psalm 1:1-3 is absolutely right when it says this. It says, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord. And on his law he meditates day and night. He is like a tree planted by streams of water that yield its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers." And so you see in Joseph this picture of fulfilled blessings, this picture of suffering, but God using suffering to strengthen his servant, to accomplish his purposes. And we should note that well. And then there's Judah, the picture of future blessings in verses 8-12. And the descriptor that we should use for Judah is really the ruler or the future king. And he's described in these terms of preeminence in verse 8, and power, verse 9, ongoing successful rule, verse 10, and incredible prosperity in verses 11 and 12. As I want you to notice that while Joseph gets the rights of the firstborn, but it is Judah, it's to him, it's his hand that will be on the necks of his enemies. It is to him that his brothers will bow. You remember Joseph's dreams? Well, his brothers have bowed. That's done. It's happened. But now Jacob is saying, Judah, your brothers will bow to you. And this is significant because there's a question here, because I want us to think about the pattern of Genesis, because we talked about how the covenant line passing through. So ever since Genesis 3:15, we had this promise of redemption. Then we have come along with Abraham. You have the promise of the covenant in people, place, and blessing. Those are the promises of the covenant. And then those are transferred on to, so far, to single descendants. You have that to the exclusion of the other. So you think of Jacob, you think of Isaac and Ishmael. Ishmael was excluded from the covenant. Isaac was the inheritor of the covenant and the promises. Then you have Jacob and Esau. Esau is excluded from the covenant. He doesn't even want it. He just wants the stuff that goes with the covenant. He don't want the covenant or the guy that goes with it. He just wants the stuff. And so we have the covenant blessings that go to Jacob to the exclusion of Esau. But when you get to the brothers here, you don't see that happening. It's not the blessings go to Judah to the exclusion of Joseph. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't go to the exclusion of all the other brothers. That's why we see this gracious act of God including all the brothers and kind of dispersing the covenant blessing amongst them. And so Joseph gets the rights of the firstborn, and we see this blessings of generations and people going on there. But we see Judah selected as the one from whom the scepter will not part from between his legs. That's a note of descendants, that there is a king coming from Judah. It's a promise all the way in Genesis. Now, a lion is the very picture of terrifying power. And it's usually used in the context of judgment, biblically, or salvation through judgment, which is always the way that God saves his people. And also the blood of grapes language. It's confusing, as well as the tying to the donkey. I mean, is anyone like, yeah, I know what that means. Yeah, he ties his donkey to the vine. That makes sense. Basically, this symbolizes great wealth, because if you were going to, you know, when I try to separate my clothes when I wash them, you know, get the colors separate, whites separate. All right. So we're doing that. And I help with the laundry. OK. And so we're doing that. But you can imagine if you were so wealthy that you washed your red garments in wine. That's the kind of money you got. You're using wine instead of water. All right. I already complained about my water bill. I don't want to see a wine bill. And so we have that, and then, sorry, I lost my place there. Then also you have the blood of grace. Then you have the donkey to the vine. That's basically the idea of several commentators. One described it as, you know, parking your Rolls Royce or your Lamborghini or whatever, just and leaving it unlocked and the keys in the ignition. It's like lighting your fire with $100 bills. You know, basically, because if you tie a donkey to a grapevine, what's he going to do? He's going to eat the grapes, right? And if you're saving the grapes, you know, it's just, you don't even care. You just tie him to the donkey. You just tie the donkey to the vine. And so it's this picture of just prosperity going on. But there's also a picture of power and kingship in these verses, as a donkey was something that royalty would ride. And the word blood brings up the biblical references of God, you know, treading the winepress of his wrath, with the grapes being his enemies. Now, David, you know, the King David, he certainly fits the bill here. He was one of Israel's greatest kings. But even David doesn't fit this. Solomon doesn't fit this. As Matthew indicates to us in a genealogy, Jesus is the true descendant of Judah and David. He is the mighty king to whom all will bow, whose rule will know no end. His rule will one day bring untold prosperity for those that belong to him, and his wrath will be fierce upon his enemies. You know, we see it in all kinds of ways in the New Testament. Some even think that, you know, Mark 11, where Jesus says to his disciples, he says, "Hey, go get me a donkey." He says, "And you go untie it from the vine. You untie it from the area and you bring it to me." So we have this, you know, so it might be an allusion there. That's a bit speculative. But you definitely have Jesus riding the donkey, which is in fulfillment of other prophecy. But perhaps no more clear is found in the book of Revelation chapter 5. And John writes, "Then I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the scroll and to break its seals?' And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep loudly because there was no one to be found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it." And so John here, he says, there's the scroll. And in this scroll, it contains all the events, all the things that are going to happen that are going to bring evil to an end and bring the kingdom of God in. How badly does he want that scroll open? The problem, though, is that it's sealed and nobody can open it. And unless somebody does, nothing's going to change. And so he weeps. And as he weeps, one of the elders said to me, John writes, "Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." And so this is really shocking stuff, because we find out here in this passage that it's not Joseph, you know, the descendant of Joseph that's going to redeem the world. It's the descendant of Judah. We like Joseph. We rooted for Joseph. We want it to be Joseph. But God's going to use Judah. Judah, who was the one who suggested they sell Joseph into slavery in the first place. Judah, who gets a whole chapter, Genesis 38, dedicated to his indiscretions, we'll call them. Yes, Judah the unworthy one. That Judah. Because God's blessing does not depend upon us. It depends upon his grace. It is bound up in his covenant that he has made. The covenant that was later established in the body and blood of his son. The blessing of the Bible is covenant blessing. It is a blessing that is leading us somewhere. That's why blessing is not just simply material, momentary prosperity. The blessing of the Bible, the blessing of God, the blessing of grace is leading us to untold blessing, to ultimate blessing. And it is given to those who, through no good work of their own, have been brought into the covenant and made a part of the family of God. This blessing of God moves along with God's purposes. And he's moving us towards the fulfillment of those purposes. God blessed the sons here in order to establish Israel, and even more to bring about Christ. And God has blessed us in the church in Christ. And he is bringing into fullness his kingdom. A kingdom that we will one day see with our own eyes. And so all these blessings, momentary and spiritual, eternal blessings, blessings great and small, are serving the larger purpose, the larger blessing of the kingdom of God. That is what it means to be blessed, to be in relationship with God, to be in union with His Son. Because whatever blessing, degree of blessing we may enjoy in this life, and it may feel like a mixed blessing, it will one day give way to the ultimate blessing of Christ when He returns. Let's pray.